This episode is brought to you by the Master of Arts in Catholic Education program at the Augustine Institute Graduate School of Theology. Dedicated to the renewal of Catholic education, this degree equips school teachers and administrators to bring Christ to the center of every classroom through a focus on sacred scripture, theology, Christian anthropology, and the traditional liberal arts. Johnny Burtka is president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, the renowned conservative student organization. Before that, he was at the American Conservative magazine. He has a nice edition, a new edition out of classic writings on leadership, just published with the title Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill, with a long introduction by Johnny. We're on a first name basis. We've had interaction for a while. Welcome. That's our topic today. Welcome, President Burtka.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
All right. Your opening sentences in the introduction give us a dismal assertion. Americans no longer have faith in their leaders. What the heck has happened?
Well, it's a question of where we want to begin. I begin the book, focusing in particular on the state of American leadership post-Cold War, reciting a narrative that I think would probably be familiar to many of your leaders. There was a sort of an overconfidence. There was a highly ideological view that history had reached its climax, and that we would be entering an era where, the historic tensions caused by religion, first and foremost, but also just cultural differences, we're going to take a back seat to the triumph of more abstract, idealistic principles of individualism, global markets, et cetera, et cetera. And, history has come back with a vengeance. Perhaps it came back at 9/11 in the most palpable way. But since then, we've had a series of crises. And with each passing crisis, it seems as though our leadership class, which I think you could define really as the people who are running our leading institutions of higher education, our think tanks, the media, have what appears to be an even narrowing set of ideologies that are dominating their approach to the world. And so what the book really aims to do is to, find a time-trusted method for educating new elites who can restore the greatness of America and the West.
I hadn't thought of that. Sort of the end of history. I mean, it almost implied, we don't really need strong leaders of vision and virtue. We're there. It's settled. We need good managers. We need people, good people who are efficient with things. I hadn't really thought about that, but you refer to examples of elite failures. Can you give us one in particular that illustrate the point?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's, I could give you many of them. I think one of them would be China's entry into the World Trade Organization and how they've upended the global order of economics. I could talk about the war on terror, which I think began with, a justified sort of response. They hit us, we're going to hit them harder back, but then morphed into an ideological project that America, to some extent, is sort of living, reaping the whirlwind to this very day. You could go on with the financial crisis, the response to COVID.
Well, with, you say the leadership's grown more ideological. Are we seeing more incompetence, just sort of bare incapacity? I mean, we saw those three college presidents testify before Congress. And, the thing that struck me right off the bat was, my goodness, these are third-rate individuals. How in the world are they supposed to be leaders of these, mega, massive, rich institutions? Incompetence factor?
Well, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I go back to my high school experience, and I want to pivot to sports for a moment, right? In sports, I went to a small rural Michigan public high school, and I remember, we had one of the players on our basketball team, he was probably 5 or 6 years older than me, was the best basketball player that my community had ever seen, you know, for all time. The kind of person who the parents spent probably hundreds of thousands of dollars on basketball training. He trained 365. I mean, he was really, really good, you know, and I just assumed this was probably when I was in seventh grade and he was a senior, looking up to him and thinking, you know, this guy is going to be an NBA star, right? And then I remember he went to a small regional college and he sat the bench for the entirety of his time there. And it kind of crashed sort of this worldview of, whoa, like the talent pool in my world is just so small, despite how many hours and days and years and thousands of dollars he poured into this craft. And I think about how in our country, in athletics, right, if you're a star quarterback, you know, playing in the Super Bowl, I mean, you have spent decades of your life and you are truly at the peak of excellence, right? You're one in a million, you know, more than that. And we've spent so much time and energy as a society doing this in the sphere of athletics. And then if you look to the political realm or to the people that are running, you know, these institutions that shape public opinion or make pivotal decisions on the course of our nation, we really do have third-rate mediocrities who, you know, you could maybe imagine that, you know, they might have been decent at on their debate club, or maybe they were on student council or something like that, but they're not, and maybe they can give a decent speech, you know, hopefully. A lot of them, you know, can't even do that anymore. And they just somehow, through a mixture of luck and political connections, find themselves running, essentially managing the decline of the most powerful empire in the world. And it's heartbreaking because we do know that it's possible in other domains like sports, but we haven't done that for political leadership.
Yeah.
One thing you acknowledge, though, in the introduction, you say only rarely do virtue and fate combine to produce exceptional leaders. So we shouldn't expect all of them to be Lincoln. You're not raising the bar to, you know, superhuman heights, but what is the realistic baseline that we want to see?
Sure. Well, I mean, great leaders emerge to, you know, there are two things within this tradition of statesmanship that I'm highlighting in the book that make a great leader. You know, on one hand, you have to have virtue, and on another hand, you have to have fortune, right? And these two things have to intersect. You know, if Washington was born 10 years earlier or 10 years later, we might not know his name. The United States of America might not exist the way that it does today. And so there is an interplay. There are ways that you can perhaps even channel fortune or what Christians might call providence, you know, and rise to the occasion. But I mean, this normally, the reason that we know a Lincoln or an FDR or a Washington is normally because their particular skill set aligned with a moment of a profound national crisis, and they came to the fore. And you know, I am confident that if a crisis were to happen again today, I don't know if I'd say I'm confident, but I am hopeful that there are enough men and women of character that would rise to the surface, right? If our crisis truly got to an existential breaking point, right? You saw this in World War II. So this definitely does happen. But I think that the challenge right now is that the people that are being educated in the elite institutions, in order to actually have these great men and women arise in a moment of crisis, you actually need a relatively large number of great men and women sort of flowing through the elite institutions that your country is producing. And so right now, the odds of getting one, I think, are a lot lower than they would have been historically, just simply because we don't have leaders that are educated in basic history, philosophy, theology.
What is this thing called mirrors for princes? What was that for?
Yeah, so this is, you know, one of my favorite literary genres of all time. And this is a big part of the reason why I wrote the book. Basically, the Mirrors for Princes is an ancient self-help manual offering conduct advice for leaders. And these existed in literally every civilization, every religious tradition known to mankind. And they were normally presented to a new king or queen or political leader when they came to power by one of two people. They were presented by educators who wanted to offer their services as a tutor for the children of a political leader, or it was an aspiring court minister who wanted a job in a new administration. They wanted to be the in the cabinet. And so these are actually short books, and they connect, you know, they're not philosophical treaties, although there are principles of political philosophy contained in them. They're really offering very practical advice, connecting the world of theory to the world of action. And for much of, you know, recorded world history, these were some of the most popular books known to mankind. And some of the ones that I include in the collection are Xenophon's The Education of Cyrus, which tells the story of a Persian conqueror and his education and how his education played a pivotal role in leading him to establish the largest empire known unto mankind at that point. That was a book that Julius Caesar is said to never have left for a battle without scrolls of Xenophon's The Education. And then fast forward all the way to Thomas Jefferson. He has two copies in his library at Monticello. You see this also with Cicero's famous book on duties, which shaped the early church fathers, the Renaissance humanists. You know, you get to Thomas More, and, you know, he never leaves the house without a copy of Cicero's On Duties in his breast pocket. So these are books that have the power, either in their own time or in generations later, to make a profound impact upon great leaders.
Now, you also note that in this tradition, this literary corpus or canon or literature broadly defined, that there is a lot that is, quote, you say, downright evil. Well, what's the point of putting that stuff in there?
Sure. That's a question that I've got a few times. I think first and foremost, I think people can have a bit of naivete about politics. And there's this idea that as long as you get a good man or a good woman, right, who either believes the right thing spiritually or politically, then their administration or their governance, it's going to go well. You know, you get a good person, the rest is going to follow. And I think politics are a lot more complicated than that, mostly because a leader is having to navigate both a number of pressures, you know, internal pressures, external pressures. It's like being a pressure cooker from every possible side. And so there's a lot of balancing that you have to do. You're trying to have the right principles and the right policies and move the ball down the field, but you're also being attacked from all angles and perhaps from inside your own head, right? Psychologically. And so the reason that I've included advice from Machiavelli, for example, or from the ancient Chinese writer Han Fei, even at times when they counsel things that go against, you know, clear Christian morality, is because if you are operating in politics or even in business, I think you ought to be aware of the tactics that people will use against you to destroy you, to ruin you. And given that human nature is fallen, these tactics seem to be quite persistent.
One reason why we've lost this tradition of guidance and leadership is because of the, quote, presentism of today's sort of education model, and I guess still the dominant one. What do you mean by presentism?
Well, to put it simply, unless something was written in the last 10 minutes, right, our elite institutions either are ignorant of their existence, right? I think if you were to ask the president of Harvard, you know, tell us a little bit about Cicero's On Duties, right? You would get blank stares, right? So there's a level of ignorance. And then maybe there's, you know, something that's a little more malicious, which is kind of rooted in ideology, but just basically says, look, these ancient texts are tainted with the sins of previous eras. And so we're going to cordon them off, and we're really not going to be allowed to engage with them. They must be worthless for the challenges or the crises or the justice issues that we have today.
You know, it just strikes me, the left has a really primary text for this. Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. Mm. It's a guidebook, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you see this in a lot of, in Herbert Marcuse and in others. You know, there's a real conscious attempt to to, you know, pop the bubble, destroy sort of the foundation of Western civilization so that they can usher in a new era of progress, which is really just nothing but, you know, a small group of highly ideological people exerting power over society through, you know, coercive means, mostly through bureaucratic means.
Yeah. But you know, I sometimes envy the left that they seem so organized toward action, you know, toward taking over institutions, toward getting in and getting the right leaders in place. Whereas the right, you know, especially the libertarian right, we're sort of more individualistic. And, you know, we talk about, you know, free market. We don't think so much about training, mm-hmm. you know, people for, you know, to step in. Okay. Now the nature of the book, this could be assigned in high school classes, right? High school civic classes.
Absolutely. And there's actually a classical school. I can't recall the name of it right now. I think it's in North Carolina or Tennessee. And one of the teachers there is actually designing a course around the book. And it would be a dream of mine actually to get this into classical and charter school and homeschool curriculums, mostly because I think young people, we need to raise their horizons. You know, one of the key insights from this tradition is if you want to become a great man or a great woman, you should spend your time reading and thinking about great men and great women. And if you can, you know, spending time with them in person, if you have members like that, mentors in your community, you know, they don't necessarily need to be great. They could just be, being good will suffice. You become like the people that you spend your time with. And so what I think a book like this could do, if we have generations of young people engaging with it, is it really elevates their political imagination and their moral imagination, and really, you know, it calls them to excellence. You know, everyone's called to be a saint, but each of us is called to be a saint in our own way, right? The church has Mother Teresa. It also has Constantine, right? And so I think we do need to think, you know, a little bit more about what are those qualities that we want from public leaders in particular. And so my hope would be that getting this book widely disseminated, getting these texts that had powers to make and unmake regimes, to build kingdoms and nations and empires, right, would do the same in our own era. Sir Philip Sidney, the British poet, Renaissance poet, said that the reason that Xenophon's The Education of Cyrus was so powerful is that it wasn't just a list of political principles, it was embedded in narrative form, in the form of an epic tale. And because of that, it could work on the imaginations and actually increase the chances that we would create future Cyruses in new eras.
Great. So we have Xenophon, Aristotle, and Cicero in the ancient section, and also someone you mentioned a few minutes ago, Han Fei. Who is he? Why is he in here?
Well, Han Fei is very brutal, but he's a lot of fun. So he was an ancient Chinese legalist in the 3rd to 4th century BC in the state of Han, living during the Zhou dynasty. And he was an advisor to several different kings at the time. And what you see in the admonitions of Han Fei is really realist advice. I mean, he's looking at the world, I would say, from a pretty materialist perspective. He actually doesn't like tradition. He's very much a pragmatist. Reading him, you know, feels somewhat similar to reading Machiavelli. But you see some interesting things in Han Fei, and I can give you a couple examples. One, he thinks that the political leader should not be out front, kind of leading in public with a very prominent persona. He thinks the political leader should be a mysterious figure who's a bit withdrawn from the people, who can cultivate this aura of authority and mystery. And he thinks it's very important for political leaders, and I think this would be a little bit more difficult in our own time, to actually not reveal their policy preferences or their ideological preferences, even to their own ministers, right? He says that if you reveal these things, then the people who are around you will flatter you, and they'll only tell you what they think you want to hear. So a good leader should welcome, you know, he should pose a question and not reveal what he's thinking, and allow his ministers to come in one after another and share their opinion. And then he should deliberate alone by himself and then determine the proper course of action. The section that I included from him focuses on the art of persuasion and how exactly you should offer advice to a political leader. And he goes through all of the various pitfalls that you might easily rush headlong into unless you're very careful and deliberate with your words. But, you know, the ultimate takeaway is that you should, as a minister, as an advisor, as a citizen, do whatever is necessary by whatever means are available to save the state and to serve the state you're willing to live in.
Right after him, you place King David. Now, isn't David full of flaws and errors? Doesn't he have some pretty poor leadership at times?
Sure. Well, I think, of course, David does, or we wouldn't have, you know, Psalm 51, which is the greatest, you know, sort of hymn and prayer of repentance probably ever written. I think you see in David, and you see in all these other leaders, that they often have great virtues accompanied by very debilitating vices. You see this if you fast forward all the way to someone like Napoleon, right? The people who are, you know, known by history to be great leaders, often they are sort of extreme examples. You know, they're pushing the boundaries of kind of what is humanly possible, and often their excellencies are in particular areas, and their vices kind of mirror those and are quite strong. So I would say another piece of advice, and you see this in Han Fei and others, is you should not, you know, we should hope and pray that we have moral and pious leaders, but the vast majority of them are not going to be that way by virtue of the fact that they're ambitious, right? And that ambition does come with certain vices. And so you should maybe measure your expectations for the moral qualities that you want to see that you will see in leaders, even though you hope and pray and work hard to ensure that they are moral.
Now, I presume that when we include leaders who have some bad examples at times, or, you know, Machiavelli, we take a little bit of the risk of a young person reading this and becoming corrupted, you know, not taking the virtue lessons, but following the Machiavellian, the badder parts of it. But that's pretty much a risk we have to take, isn't it? We can't try to control over much the development of these leaders, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that they will encounter the Machiavellian behavior. And I'm actually, you know, I'm quite... There are many aspects of Machiavelli that I'm personally quite fond of. You know, that's not to say I'm Machiavellian in my outlook, but I just think a lot of it is, you know, there's certain advice that it's like, you just need to be aware of this, you know, and also there are certain things that I think are, you know, might be more applicable in our own time for leaders. And I think you're going to encounter the world with all of it, you know, the good, bad, and ugly at some point in your life. And so I think if you're doing this kind of within the context of, let's say, classical education or homeschooling, or you're at the collegiate level and this is part of the core curriculum, you know, I think you really do need that exposure with a trusted mentor or professor who spent a long time thinking about it to really, you know, help you understand and navigate it. Because a lot of these thinkers really did change the course of history. And, you know, as a student of history, you're going to encounter this stuff regardless. So I think it's very important to include it.
Yeah. You know, we have a big problem, as you noted, you know, today, our, you know, civic knowledge, historical knowledge is pretty low in America. And we don't seem to be producing a lot of great leaders. If you look at the 18-year-old, male or female, maybe they'll look for different things. In 2024, what are young people looking for? Because, I mean, a lot of them don't have a father in the home. A lot of them have no God the Father in their lives of any kind. Role models, you know, celebrities, sports figures, not very good leadership models. Are they hungry for something better?
They are incredibly hungry. And I think if you look out at, you know, who are the popular influencers. Sure, you have a lot of the negative, you know, influences in popular culture, but you see that young people are also hungry for people like Jordan Peterson, who are offering them life advice. Here's what you need to do. And to some extent, I think much more than even my own millennial generation, Gen Z and the generation beneath them is actually looking for people to tell them what to do, how to behave on the most fundamental level. Make your bed when you wake up in the morning. You know, it's shocking that advice like that would capture millions of people, but it really gets to more fundamental kind of a human desire to, you know, to be excellent, to be good, to kind of get out of the rut that they find themselves in. And just they're grasping for something because we no longer have the structures that would have that used to kind of inculcate the traditional virtues. I just finished a 3-day seminar with about 22 students, college students from a mix of campuses, from University of Dallas to Duke to University of Wisconsin-Madison. We did 3 days doing a deep dive on this book. And I was just blown away by, one, you know, seeing how intelligently they were engaging with the various texts and the thinkers, but most specifically, they were hungering for life applications from the text. And that was actually the most popular conversations were, okay, what does this mean for my own life? And we would unpack that, you know, in detail. And each of these thinkers have very practical things that any young person can apply tomorrow to make them more excellent.
Very good. Teddy Roosevelt, we have in here. Many people don't know of the remarkable composure under fire that he showed in the Spanish-American War. He genuinely was heroic at that time. But what selection, just to give us an example, what selection have you chosen from him?
So, and this is an important caveat, the Mirrors for Princes tradition really did die out, you know, shortly after the Renaissance, as we transitioned into the modern era. And so what I ended up doing for the sake of this book was to say, we need to bring this tradition back for our own day. And as a part of that, let's include some texts that could function as mirrors for princes from our own era. So I have some Washington, some Teddy Roosevelt, some Churchill, and Charles de Gaulle. So with Teddy Roosevelt, I chose a speech that he gave called Citizenship in a Republic. And he's basically in this speech doing two things. One, you know, basically saying in a republic, the quality of your leaders, it's going to ebb and flow with the quality of the average citizen, because your leaders are going to emerge from the citizenry. So you do need broad, high standards for education for large swaths of people if you ever hope to have good leadership at the top. The second thing, and he kind of concludes with perhaps one of his most famous quotations, he's talking about the man in the arena, right? This is the man who will never be counted among the souls who never know, you know, the quote is getting jumbled in my mind. It's basically saying, get in the arena and fight, right? It's better to strive valiantly for noble ends and to come up short than it is to never have gotten into the arena in the first place and to have your lot be with those timid souls who neither know victory or defeat. So it's a call to action that I think is very suited for our own time, you know, in America today. I think there's a temptation among conservatives to say, oh, we can just withdraw from these battles, right? Things are just so overwhelming. They're so icky. They're so corrupt that it's best if we just disengage from society. And I think, you know, this book, this tradition, Teddy Roosevelt in particular, it's a call to action, a call to get into the arena for the sake of, you know, the future generations that will inherit our country.
The book is Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill. Johnny Burka, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.